time for Undercurrent. We're going to be discussing the problem of human trafficking and modern-day slavery. And my guest for the first segment will be Leora Kasten from the American Anti-Slavery Group in Boston. Leora?
Yep.
Could you provide some background information on your organization?
Sure. The American Anti-Slavery Group is an international non-governmental organization, and we work to abolish modern-day slavery internationally.
So what practices exactly are included under the mantle of slavery, as the terms used today?
Well, there are a number of different terms people use. Most commonly, there's forced labor, sex slavery, chattel slavery. There's agricultural labor. There's also forced conscription into the army, forced marriage.
You mentioned chattel slavery. Is that generational slavery?
One element to it. I think that's the type of slavery people think of the most, especially when you're talking to Americans. They think of our own history with slavery, and that most certainly was chattel slavery, in which you can buy and sell a slave. The slave is your property, and yes, definitely the slave can be inherited or born into slavery.
In the United States, which areas of the problem would you say are the most relevant?
It's difficult to say. In the United States, there's forced labor, forced domestic labor, is pretty common, and that kind of pops up every once in a while in private homes. It's very difficult to track because very often somebody is trafficked from another country to the United States and then forced to work as a maid or something in a private home. There's also a lot of sex slavery that occurs particularly in major cities such as New York City, Los Angeles, but it's really all over. And again, often someone is trafficked from abroad and then tricked into working as a sex slave there. Very often the person gives consent to be brought to the United States, either legally or illegally, and then is tricked into being a sex slave and is not able to leave. But sometimes it does happen where someone living in the United States, a United States citizen, is caught in sex slavery. And there's also forced agricultural labor, particularly in Florida and the South.
So you say most of the victims of this crime are tricked into believing that they have an opportunity that doesn't currently exist in their own country, and so that's how they entice people into a contract. And once they have the contract signed and they get the person into another country, how do they keep control over the victims of trafficking and slavery? How do they keep them from getting away?
Well, one thing is once they get into the country, their passport and all their documentation is taken. So they have no identity in terms of the law. They feel helpless. Also, often, if they're trafficked to another country, they don't speak the language and they can't communicate with anybody around them. Also, they don't know to go to the police because very often the police in many countries are complicit in the slavery rings, and particularly sex slavery rings. And so they can't trust the police, or they think they can't trust the police. And also the people that are holding them captive often use scare tactics by saying, if you try to escape, I'll kill you, or I'll cut off your leg, or something like that. But also, if you go outside, it's going to be dangerous for you, and they're going to kill you, and they're not going to listen to you. And so they're afraid of the people around them, the only people that really they even have a chance of helping them. They're afraid to reach out.
So in a strange way, the trafficker becomes the family for the trafficked victim because it's the only person they, oddly enough, have trust in and contact with.
Yeah, it's definitely the only person they have contact with, but I don't know about that.
Well,
trust
versus what they were told. At least they know what's going to happen,
you know, in their
current situation, where the rest of their surroundings is kind of an unknown, and all they have is what they're being told.
Right. I think that's a big part of it, the unknown, that, you know, even if they fear for their lives, staying with the person who is now their slave master, escaping in many ways is much more scary. And so you see that sometimes people try to escape right away and are caught and then beaten, abused another way, and then never try again, or will try many, many, many years later. And it's just a lot of times it has to be brought to this breaking point for the person because they're so afraid of of trying to leave, that it just has to get so incredibly bad where they say to themselves, you know what, I'm not even afraid of dying anymore. I'm just going to go.
So you mentioned that it's prevalent around the world. So what kind of numbers are we talking about on the global scale and with regard to the United States? Do you have some numbers as to how many people are involved in this as
sure.
victims?
So globally, the figure that was introduced by the International Labor Organization was 27 million, and that's the number that we've been using. But the ILO recently introduced another report saying it's more like 12.3 million. However, once you read it, and they'll tell you it's really only figuring in known and recorded instances of slavery. So they're going around the world interviewing people and finding out about these actual cases of slavery and then documenting them, and that's 12.3 million. But the biggest issue with human trafficking and slavery is that you don't know where the victims are. So many more than 12.3 million, and we're and a lot of other organizations use the figure of 27 million, which is also a conservative estimate, and I'm sure it's many more than that even, and that's globally. In the United States, the CIA says that up to 17,500 people are trafficked to the U.S. every year for exploitation and forced labor, mostly women and children. So, again, that's probably a very conservative estimate. And it's very hard to come up with numbers for this because, like I said, the fact of the situation is that you can't get to these people. You don't know who they are, and they can't get to the outside world to tell them their stories. But we're trying to change that.
It was over 17,000 per year coming into the United States that they know of. Is the number increasing in recent years? Does it seem to be on the rise?
Well, the CIA had started putting out this number fairly recently. The U.S. really only, I think, really became aware of the global crime and the global issue of human trafficking about 5-6 years ago. So since then, they've been perfecting their tools of how to measure it and how to prevent it. So what I've seen from the CIA statistics is that they're going down, but I don't think that's actually a reflection of changes within our society, considering we've only had anti-trafficking laws on the books for 5 years. So I think it's just that the CIA had initially said 50,000 and then went down to about 20, and now it's 17,500. And I think that's just because they don't really know how to measure it, and they're gradually coming up with the tools to measure it. But I don't think that it is actually reflecting a decrease in human trafficking to and within this country. And I've spoken to people from the Department of Justice and the State Department. They'll tell you it's new, and they're just learning how to implement them.
So you mentioned 5 years ago, that's when the Victims of Trafficking and Violence Protection Act was passed.
That's right.
And now the State Department, they make updates every year on the worldwide problem, and they try to spotlight countries that fail to meet minimum requirements that are set down, and I would assume, in that act, and don't seem to even be concerned about improving the situation.
Right, and in many cases, the governments are complicit in supporting the system of slavery in the country, so...
Have the State Department reports spotlighting of these certain countries seem to have any effect on the countries that are singled out as major violators?
In terms of the U.S. imposing sanctions, I haven't seen anything of that sort or anything affecting a major change in that sense. But I do think that countries that are in Tier 3 or the Tier 2 watch list, they do feel a sense of pressure because many of them rely on the United States for aid, and even though they wouldn't, if they remained in the Tier 3 country, the Tier 3 classification for several years, then they would theoretically have money cut off to them. It wouldn't be humanitarian aid, but it would be, you know, things for education and other things, which... You know, may make the problem worse, but they do feel pressure then. Once you put money on it, then these governments will get their act together.
The money numbers are huge. In Thailand, the yearly income from human trafficking and slavery, especially sexual slavery, is equal to half of their annual budget. And I think Japan, the number was equal to the entire defense budget. If I can imagine, you know, unless sanctions are really strict, it may not be enough to shake them up enough to change it.
Right. And it's a big problem. I work with a woman from Sri Lanka who is trafficked to Lebanon and forced to work as a maid. And so she had signed a 2-year contract to do this, but she didn't realize that, first of all, she wasn't going to be paid. You know, that went against the terms of her contract. And she was also beaten terribly and not allowed to leave and had no communication with anybody. She was also starved. But I work with her now. She lives in the United States, and she's been doing research on human trafficking and slavery from Sri Lanka to countries in the Middle East. And not only is it the same as when she was enslaved almost 25 years ago, but the government of Sri Lanka has set up classes to train women on how to use a vacuum cleaner and, you know, different types of modern technology as it relates to domestic work. That way these women can go to the Middle East and work. And a lot of them don't come home, and a lot of them are enslaved. And the government of Sri Lanka is not going to do anything about that right now, because they need for these women to go work abroad and send money home, because it's an economically unstable country.
And not only do they get the remittance back home, but they also don't have to spend government funds to support the numbers of people that end up leaving the country.
That's right.
You mentioned how the woman is actually helping you out with your operation. Now, so what exactly does the American Anti-Slavery Group do to fight this problem?
Well, we're primarily an activist organization. So we do have a lot of research materials on our website, which is www.iabolish.com. In addition, what we do is we try to educate people about modern-day slavery, because most people don't know about it. That's really the first step. And then it's, you know, lobbying the United States government and governments around the world to try to get them to put laws and to implement them, to really make sure that people are abiding by these laws, anti-trafficking laws. We do a lot of grassroots activism, mobilizing activists across the country. We are in touch with about 40,000 members of our I Abolish Freedom Action Network across the country, and getting them to send letters and sign petitions and come to our rallies.
And you have I see you have a National Speakers Bureau of former slaves.
That's right. That's something really, I think, unique that the American Anti-Slavery Group provides. And that's empowering and training these survivors to speak out. And when I talk about educating people about modern-day slavery, a lot of it is having these survivor speakers tell their stories and then talk about modern-day slavery worldwide and how we can work to stop it. But I think we're one of the few organizations that are really empowering these survivors, like this woman, Beatrice Fernando, who was trafficked from Sri Lanka to Lebanon, or like Frances Bach, who was a slave in Sudan for 10 years, from the age of 7 to 17. And many other survivors that we really try to get out there and tell their stories. And I think it's also therapeutic for them, because many of them, even though they've escaped slavery, they have a slave mentality where they're ashamed. And, you know, there's something about the human spirit that their slave masters, you know, try to break the spirit in them. And it's shameful. They feel ashamed that they were enslaved. In many countries, they shame the survivors, you know, for having been victimized, as if it's their fault.
A lot of times when, even after the victim's been rescued and rehabilitated and then repatriated, they're alienated by their home society and then often re-trafficked right back into the system. Is there a way to determine whether or not it's best for the victim to be repatriated to their own country, or or possibly to another country, and how expensive is the training and the rehabilitation? How long does it take? Kind of.
I can't really put a time limit on it. I don't know. I think it depends on each person. I know in Beatrice's case, she went back to Sri Lanka after having escaped from her master in Lebanon. She was first in the hospital because the way she escaped was she had to jump off the balcony. So she was paralyzed for a while. But then she went back to Sri Lanka and was living there for a number of years and was really ostracized by her community, and eventually moved to the United States with her son and the man who's now her husband. And only once living in the United States for almost 20 years is she, you know, able to speak out and doesn't feel as much this shame, although it still is with her a little bit. It depends on each person. You know, Beatrice was strong enough to come to the United States, but a lot of people just want to go home. They just want to be with their families, and they don't want to talk about it ever again. And I think that is part of this slave mentality and this feeling of shame, because they don't have anything to be ashamed of, and what they should be doing is screaming out to the entire world so that people are aware and can stop it and make sure that it doesn't happen again.
You mentioned that you also try to get people to contact and lobby members in Congress. Have you identified any specific members in Congress that seem to be extremely interested in this issue?
Yes, Representative Chris Smith and also Senator Brownback. They have been enormously helpful on many different fronts. And one of our biggest campaigns is to stop slavery in Sudan. And chattel slavery exists there today, and the government is complicit in it. And now people are reading in the papers a lot about the genocide that's occurring now in the western Darfur region. But it started in the south, the genocide and the slave raids, and it's still going on in Sudan at large. So we started our own Sudan activism website, sudanactivism.com, and it's getting people to contact, again, the representatives and senators. Brownback has, again, been just incredibly helpful on that front, as well as the anti-human trafficking front. So it's interesting how they kind of blend together. But certainly there are representatives in this country that are very concerned, and just they really work very hard to stop human trafficking.
And your effort with the Sudanese should resonate here in Vermont, because I believe the refugee resettlement program has recently brought a lot of Sudanese refugees here to the Burlington area. So there are probably numerous people from the country here, and if people are listening, they can kind of get in contact with the Vermont Refugee Resettlement Program and see if, you know, they can help out there too. You mentioned that you focus on activism and exposure of the issue to people. Are you working closely with any other organizations that do other things to solve this problem, or try to solve it, or slow it down a bit?
Sure. We work with a number of different organizations. One organization that we have a close relationship with is Christian Solidarity International, and they work in Sudan on the ground to free slaves and then help support them by giving them survival kits. And when people donate to the American Anti-Slavery Group, that's one thing that their donations can go for, in addition to our other activities. Another group that I was working with a few months back, I went to India to investigate child slavery. And I was working with the South Asian Coalition on Child Servitude. And they also are just incredible. They do so many different things. But one thing they do is they conduct raids of carpet loom factories, so many different industries where children are enslaved. And they look for the children, and they talk to the children, and they gain their trust, and they help the children leave these places. And many times that involves the organization having to bribe the police just to get to allow them to get these children out of these situations of slavery. And then they put them in this home to rehabilitate them and to give them education and teach them vocational skills. And it's just a wonderful organization, and they're working with children, you know, so it really, really touches your heart.
And you mentioned the loom factories. In addition to donating money to organizations such as yours, how can listeners take action to assure that they're not buying or purchasing products that were produced by slave labor or child labor? Is there a sort of buyer's guide, or is there information out there about how to determine whether or not the product was produced with slave labor?
Well, I've seen a number of organizations that monitor different industries to make sure that they're not abusing their laborers, like in the sense of, you know, fair wage or fair conditions, that kind of thing. And so I haven't seen any organizations that are particularly looking for situations of forced labor, but they just want, you know, like kind of fair standards. And so within that, when they're doing their research and they're visiting these different factories, in order to promote fair standards, they're also, you know, would have to protect against forced labor. So
that's just one. That would be one of the facets they're looking at.
Right. And so there are a number of different organizations, like the Fair Trade Federation, Rugmark, which was actually started by South Asian Coalition on Child Servitude. If you're buying an Asian rug, look for the Rugmark symbol, and that ensures that no children were laboring, working on this rug. American Apparel is another organization.
They're the Southern California manufacturer of clothing. Is that American Apparel?
Yeah, and they also, from what I understand, they're basically ensuring that sewn products are produced under lawful, humane, and ethical conditions. So, again, that's, you know, more general, but underneath that, it would ensure that there's no forced labor going on.
I want to give you a chance to let the listeners know exactly how they can get in contact with your group and donate to your group to help support your efforts.
Great. Just to reiterate, our name, we're the American Anti-Slavery Group. Our website is iabolish.com. And if you want to stay in touch and you know, make sure that you're up to date on anti-trafficking news and anti-slavery rallies and, you know, petitions and all these different things, you can sign up for our Freedom Action Network right on the site at iabolish.com. And any questions, we welcome callers and emails. And, you know, we'll get back to you and work with you. And we're just, you know, we're very grassroots. So give us a call, email us, and we'll respond and see what we can do to work with you all to end human trafficking and slavery.
Thank you very much. I believe President Bush mentioned this issue. Was it the last State of the Union address he mentioned the trafficking problem?
Yeah, he's been very good about it, putting it on the agenda. And then it was, you know, under his administration that they passed the Victims of Trafficking and Violence Protection Act. So his administration has really been forefront in this battle.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank you again. It's Leora Kasten. The organization is the American Anti-Slavery Group, and it's located in Boston, Massachusetts. The website is www.iabolish.com. We're going to have the second segment at my normal time at 11:30. We're going to have Namju Cho from the Coalition to Abolish Slavery and Trafficking. Thank you, Leora.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Kevin Patrick. You're listening to another edition of Undercurrent. The guest is Namju Cho, the Communications and Policy Director for the Coalition to Abolish Slavery and Trafficking. If you want to start off by describing what your organization does.
I'm with CAST, which is what our organization is known as. We're based in Los Angeles, and We provide social services, legal services, as well as conducting advocacy and training around the issue of trafficking. We're one of the only organizations in the country that delve specifically on this issue by providing both services and conducting advocacy. We meet the short-term needs of the survivors of trafficking so that they can basically begin to get their lives back to normal. And we also delve into the long-term training and policy advocacy aspect to make sure that the rights of trafficked persons are protected. And we're proud that just last year we were able to open the first shelter for trafficked persons in the country. And we just had our first year anniversary, and it's going very well.
When I spoke with Leora earlier, we were talking about the numbers, and the numbers she gave were, the estimates were 27 million people worldwide and 17,500 people trafficked into the U.S. every year. Does that sound about right?
Yes, that's correct. The 27 million number, I believe, is an estimate that came from Free the Slaves, which, is, as you know, is an organization based in the Massachusetts area. And this number, 27 million, is more than twice the number of people taken from Africa during the entire transatlantic slave trade in the 19th century. So you can sort of begin to see and put this into perspective of how prevalent this problem is today of modern-day slavery that it still exists. As far as the number of people trafficked into the United States, the range that is often given, well, as you said, 17,500 is the high range, and then the low range is 14,500. And that number is from the U.S. government Department of Justice estimate from the last report that they gave in 2004. And the next report, actually, is going to be coming up soon on June 1st, the Trafficking in Persons report that the State Department puts out every year that focuses on anti-trafficking efforts globally of all these different countries. That is due to come out on June 1st. And then shortly after that, the U.S. government itself releases a report on the U.S. government activities to combat trafficking. And once that comes out, a lot of these estimates oftentimes are revised or changed, or and then you'll maybe get a more updated number. But that is the estimate that we have as far as being the most recent one.
And the report you're talking about that comes out every year, that's the one that divides countries up into different tiers as to how
exactly.
effective they are and even how interested they are in combating the problem.
Exactly. They have Tier 1 and then Tier 2 and Tier 3. And if a country doesn't really demonstrate any political will or any kinds of policies or activities to combat human trafficking, then they are either, relegated to another, a lower tier. And if a country is basically stuck in a lower tier for 2 years in a row, they may be subject to non-humanitarian sanctions. And that is considered a way that the U.S. government would try to improve or prompt the countries to have these kinds of activities, anti-trafficking activities. But there are some concerns with the report. State Department officials themselves have recognized that there are a lot of challenges in trying to collect the data for which this report is released. And they rely on the consulates, the embassies, and the embassies then go sort of to some of the non-governmental organizations doing the groundwork. And it's a lot of countries that they do profile. So it's got some challenges as far as having the data collection and how these things are being evaluated. But, some countries, for instance, because they're getting a lot of heat from the U.S. government through this report, maybe the previous year, they would go ahead and introduce legislation, for instance, on trafficking. But sometimes, our concern is that they're just kind of doing it for show and they're not really doing it sort of substantively, really implementing the policies. So I think it's really important that, the sanctions and those things could prompt them to do certain things, like raiding or busting high-profile cases. But it's really important to sort of follow up and make sure that they implement a lot of the things that they do introduce so that it's not just a hollow some sort of policy to appease the American government.
Is there a lot of international coordination between various countries and regions to combat this situation?
I think it varies by region. I think in some regions, I believe like in the Eastern European or the European region, there has been, maybe because of the European Union, the existence, there has been a lot of regional cooperation between different governments. And I know particularly in the Eastern European area, I think an organization called La Strada has been doing a really good job. They focus mostly on sex trafficking, but has been doing a really good job to sort of raise awareness and work with different countries on maybe addressing root causes and doing some prevention work. I think that within the U.S., for instance, and working with other countries, we've sort of begun, but it's, as you said, it's really, I think, in the early stages, and we could do so much more as far as working with the root originating countries. And the State Department does, you know, the government does fund, and we have other private foundations that fund prevention efforts in a lot of the originating countries, you know, to make sure that addressing, you know, the poverty issues, to make sure to do some sort of vocational training so that the people there are not going to fall into, you know, the trap or being lured here and recruited and be trafficked. So those things, I think, are beginning to happen. As far as CAST is concerned, I mean, we've done some sort of collaborative trainings with a Mexican non-governmental organization last year. And I just did a presentation in front of a lot of international visitors through the State Department program from 11 different countries. And most of those countries are source countries for a lot of the victims that we serve of human trafficking. And, you know, they were just expressing after the presentation how, you know, how much of a need there was to do more training and awareness and prevention activities from their countries. And they invited us to come and how we should be doing more across the border. So that's something that we would definitely like to do down the road, to do more trainings, cross trainings internationally, and to do more joint projects so we can address those root causes such as poverty and globalization and things like that.
So who exactly is behind the machinery or the mechanisms that are in place that that run this whole system globally?
I think it varies again. There isn't one sort of set profile of what a trafficker looks like. I think it can range from, you know, organized crime is most certainly involved when it comes to a lot of the sex trafficking rings worldwide. And, you know, it's not any mystery that the organized crime is involved. I mean, it's low risk. It's very high profits. You know, it's the third largest, most profitable criminal enterprise after drugs and arms trafficking. So organized crime is definitely one sort of, you know, trafficker profile. However, if you look at some of the domestic people just bringing in domestic servants or, you know, it's really about one greedy, sort of really wealthy individual. And so it can be anyone as far as recruitment. It can be anyone who has a trust of the trafficking victim or the victim. And it's, you know, based on our experience, it's been associates, it's been family friends, it's been family members, neighbors, teachers, you know, village chiefs, and it can pretty much be anyone who has a trust of the victim. So it really isn't just organized crime and these really, you know, even though they are very much involved, but a lot of the cases we see are not organized crime. And I think we need to really make that clear as far as sort of thinking about, you know, who these traffickers can be. It really can be your neighbor, literally. We've seen, you know, a lot of people who help people escape from their neighbor's house because they saw that something was wrong and something was suspicious, or the person in that neighbor's house, the domestic worker, asked for help. So it's about, yeah, it's about greed. It's about, you know, wanting to control, and it's about power. And it can be pretty much anyone.
And it's even a lot more difficult to combat when it's not an organized crime situation, because if it's
exactly
so individualized, it's nearly impossible to track.
Exactly. And the domestic workers are oftentimes the most invisible, as you said, and the most difficult to find. They're often trapped in these very large, sometimes suburban mansions, and rarely allowed to go out on their own. They're always escorted. And if they do go out, they're told not to speak with anyone, none of the neighbors. And they're afraid to speak to the neighbors, too, even though they may not be in the same, you know, camp as a trafficker. The trafficker basically tells them, it's no use going to talk to anyone in the neighborhood because, you know, they're basically all of our friends and they're not going to really listen to you. So yeah, it's really about maybe educating a lot of the communities, because a lot of the people who have been enslaved as domestic workers that we have served have been able to come out thanks to a good Samaritan who helped them escape, or they saw something was wrong and then they tipped the law enforcement agencies and anonymously, and were able to help them come out of their situation. So that's one of the reasons that we really feel like educating the communities is an important aspect of what we do as well.
And the main way they keep them in the situation they're in, mm-hmm. is once they get into a foreign country, they automatically take their papers and their mm-hmm. visas, and so they're stuck as, you know, irregular migrants. Mm-hmm. And they also charge an exorbitant fee to get them into the other country, and so they're kind mm-hmm. of stuck.
Right, and suddenly when they're recruited, of course none of this is mentioned, and then once they cross the border or arrive in this country, suddenly they owe a so-called debt, which, you know, they've never heard of before. It could be up to, you know, $20,000, $50,000, and they basically, you have to work this off. And in some instances, that never actually happens as far as paying it off, because, you know, they would charge room and board, and they would charge, you know, they wouldn't let them go to the stores, and but they would say, okay, I'm going to get a bar of soap for you, and just charge a huge premium to what the price actually is. So they never really pay off their so-called debt anyway. And that's happened with the El Monte case, the landmark sweatshop case, in which CAFT was sort of founded in the aftermath. And this case was in 1995, and this is exactly what happened. 72 Thai garment workers were being forced to work in the sweatshop, makeshift, and it was a huge home in the suburban area of Los Angeles, and they had a company store, a so-called company store. They weren't allowed to go out to buy their basic necessities, and they were forced to buy things in this company store. And a bar of soap cost $20, and they were never able to repay their debt because everything they bought was just ridiculously overpriced. So that's one of the other ways that the trafficker is able to hold them captive. And you're right, psychological coercion is a huge part of what modern-day slavery is. And in addition to legal coercion, you know, which is about, oh, well, if you go out, the police are going to arrest you, they're going to rape you.
Which is true in a lot of the countries that they're trafficked to, I would assume.
Exactly, exactly. So they, you know, they totally play on those types of fears and, you know, distrust of law enforcement that they already have, and sort of, you know, further exploit that, and the fact that they don't speak any English or know anything about the, you know, their rights in this country. They further say, well, you know, the reason you're here, you know, is because I decided to take you. No one else will take you. You should be thankful that I'm even, you know, willing to use your services when you're so useless. And, you know, one of our clients, traffickers, told her that dogs have more rights than you in this country. And if you go to the police, no one's going to believe you because you have no papers, you speak no English. What are you going to do?
What are the traffickers looking for? Sort of a profile of a typical victim? Are there some common characteristics they're looking for? I'm assuming they're going to poor villages that are mm-hmm. isolated from the cities and isolated from, you know, modern communication. Mm-hmm. And is it different in different regions of the world what they're looking for, and what kind of labor they're trafficked into?
I mean, I would say that it again varies, and I don't know that there's just one particular kind of trafficking that's just typical of certain regions or cities. But again, you look at the root causes, and with the easy transfer of goods and services, it's just, you know, human beings with the low risk, again, that I mentioned before, is just one more thing that's just very easily transferred across borders. And yeah, I mean, wherever there's poverty, pretty much, there's going to be people, and women and children, as you know, are just most vulnerable because they have the least access to money or jobs. They're expected to rear children and feed extended families at the same time. Men, of course, are trafficked too. We have a larger percentage of women at this time, But, you know, women and girls are they're the most desperate to make the ends meet, and they are being targeted by traffickers. So, you know, the typical scenario would be something like, you know, a woman, it involves recruitment, and they say, hey, you know, how would you like to go and work in the U.S. And have a well-paying job? Don't worry about any of the passports or papers or visas. You know, it's all taken care of. You just show up. And oftentimes, you know, they don't say yes the first time because, you know, it's not easy to leave your family, your children behind to go to a country where you have absolutely no support network, you don't speak the language, you don't know anyone. And, you know, the people who go are really strong people that try to make that decision. It takes a lot of courage to make that decision in the first place. And oftentimes our clients tell us that maybe after the second or third time that this recruiter stops by, they finally just cave in. And sometimes the children would be, you know, telling our clients, you know, don't worry about us. You know, why don't you just go and try to see what it's like? And of course, when they go, it's just, you know, they have no idea that they're going to put into slavery. So, yes, it's mostly the lowest income groups, the underemployed, the unemployed, ones with the least access to capital and resources, from the poorest countries and the regions and the rural areas within those countries. If you look at the regional makeup of the folks that are estimated to be trafficked into the United States, Asia Pacific has the largest percentage with about 40%. And the absolute numbers for that is about 5,000 to 7,000 people estimated to be trafficked from Asia Pacific. And then that's followed by Latin America with another 30%, and then Europe and Eurasia with another 30%. And the rest, Africa, Middle East, and South Asia is about 10%. So you can kind of begin to see where a lot of these people are coming from. Having said that, if you look at some of the profiles, there are definitely instances where, you know, the folks that have been trafficked don't necessarily fit into these sort of, you know, poorest economic groups and undereducated and those type. We have, you know, people who went to college. We have women who were teachers in their countries. In fact, we just had a very high-profile civil case of a client who was a teacher in her home country, and she came here sort of as a domestic worker and ended up being enslaved by a couple. The man in the couple, he was a Sony studio executive. He was an attorney. He was a vice president of the legal group, and he really should have known better. But he, you know, didn't really give her good pay. She was forced to sleep on a dog bed. She worked 18-hour days. A lot of the dogs that they had in their household were better fed than the woman herself, the domestic worker. And the good news is, you know, Santa Monica, so there was the civil suit, and the Santa Monica jury basically mandated that the couple pay this woman, our client, $825,000. So that's sort of a happy ending. But, you know, if you look at how someone who's so just obviously wealthy and should really know a lot of these labor laws committing these types of crimes, it kind of shows how far we have to go as far as raising awareness on the issue.
And does the current global economic system kind of exacerbate the problem by allowing such free movement of capital so corporations and businesses are looking for the lowest possible labor, but at the same time, immigration laws are being strengthened, you know, becoming more strict, and so people can't flow with the money, and so it makes it an incentive to traffic people to places where labor laws are less strict.
Absolutely. I would say, you know, the race, so-called race to the bottom that manufacturers have for profits and demand for cheap, unregulated labor, like you said, is absolutely one of, you know, the biggest culprits of this type of, you know, trafficking, because if there wasn't this type of, you know, informal sector demand for, you know, basically free labor or slave labor, as you saw in the case of the, you know, the farm, the tomato pickers in Florida, there wouldn't be this kind of demand for this work, and this type of trafficking may not be as, you know, egregious and as it would be happening as prevalently. Again, the corporations, I think should be, I think there isn't enough of an emphasis of, you know, the private sector's role in this entire phenomenon of trafficking. I think that, the corporations should really take on, more of a prominent role as far as, you know, being proactive and taking action to curb this crime. But maybe there's just too much of profits at stake for them. And I think the whole situation in the Ciudad of Juarez is the same thing. I mean, what are these maquiladoras doing, and why is this happening, and what are all these mysterious deaths and brutal, you know, murders? And I mean, it could just extend anywhere in the world where there's a large presence as far as a corporation, a foreign corporation. And you're absolutely right that the U.S. trade policies and a lot of the foreign policies really exacerbate this problem in many countries. Just looking at the NAFTA, I mean, a lot of Mexicans were not, you know, they're out of a job. They were just not able to make ends meet or get a job or do anything in Mexico after NAFTA passed. And, you know, there's just a huge inflow. And yeah, it's not, we don't believe that tightening the borders in this sort of anti-terrorism era is the best solution to curb trafficking. This isn't an immigration issue. This is not a criminalization issue either. It's really a human rights issue. And I think that a lot of the government officials and should really sort of fully understand that. And one of the things that we're trying to do at CAST is to make sure that that sort of perspective is going to be incorporated in anything, any sort of policies or programs or activities that we implement to make sure that the human rights are going to be protected, first and foremost, of these victims of this horrible crime.
Yeah, it's ironic that you mentioned the NAFTA situation, because I remember when it was being sold to the public, they were saying that just the opposite would happen. It was going to build this middle class in Mexico, and so there would be less of an incentive to cross the border into the U.S. But since they dropped a lot of the barriers and privatized everything, big companies moved in and ran local businesses out of work and local agriculture out of business, and so people had to move to find jobs elsewhere.
Exactly. And, I mean, I would like to just cite one example of how a corporation sort of came around after a lot of advocacy on the part of the service providers. You may be familiar with the Taco Bell campaign in which, you know, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers based in Florida, consisting mostly of, you know, Mexican, Latin American, and Caribbean men, I guess male farm workers, advocated to increase the amount of money in which 1 pound of tomatoes that they picked on a day-to-day basis, the price will be risen by one penny, basically. And this was the point of contention. It's hard to believe that it was just 1 penny that they were fighting for, but it's a huge victory. They were asking just for 1 penny more for a basket of tomatoes, and they had to boycott it for over, I think, 2 to 3 years for them to even get to this point. And finally, Yum Brands, which owns Taco Bell, was able to succumb. And I think this shows, you know, it was a long battle, but I think it's a great first step to kind of show how the corporations can really make a difference. And, you know, honestly, I really don't think this is going to make a huge dent on their bottom line. And just being able to be, you know, responsible corporations that can be a model to others to kind of follow suit. So I just want to, you know, praise Yum Brands, even though it was a long battle, and the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in particular, for their work in advancing that.
And it just shows how effective the work you're doing in other groups to just shine a light on the issue, to the point where the public relations problem is more costly than the penny a bushel that that they have to pay. And it's interesting you mentioned the agricultural workers from Latin America down there, because I also read that, you know, getting back to the sex trafficking, the women from Latin America, most of them are trafficked into the country to actually service the laborers that are up here from Latin America. So things
the migrant farmers.
Yeah, they bring the women in to be there to service the workers since they're away from their homes. And so it's kind of all tied together. Another American issue, which was recently in the news, the situation in the North Marianas Islands and Saipan. Tom DeLay and his association with Jack Abramoff seems to be doing all he can to avoid the U.S. Congress enacting legislation to just make our territory there in North Marianas Islands, Saipan and such, adhere to the same laws that we have here, because a lot of people buy goods that say made in the USA, but they're not made, you know, in the states of the USA. They're made in this territory. They're allowed to put that label on there, but the workers there aren't subject to the same rights and liberties that the workers in under U.S. law.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that, because I was just thinking about the largest case of trafficking in U.S. history, which was, as you know, the American Samoa case. It was discovered last year, about a year or a little over a year ago, and it was prosecuted last year for sure. And it involved 200 Chinese and Vietnamese workers, and they were forced to work in a sweatshop. And the conditions in the sweatshop and the located in the American Samoa were extremely egregious. They were virtually at the level of where the El Monte case workers were. They were forced to work and live in the same quarters. They're very unhygienic. They never got breaks. They were threatened. They said, hey, if you try to escape, you know, this is what's going to happen to you. And they showed pictures of other people who tried to escape with, you know, just severe physical harm being done to their bodies. And they were basically just threatening them to keep them in there. And you're absolutely right. I think that's an extremely serious problem, that they're not being subject to the same laws, despite the fact that they get away with the Made in USA label. And I think the American Samoa case is, you know, a poster child example of how this is being abused. And, well, thankfully, those traffickers in that case were prosecuted, and a lot of the victims were able to, you know, come to the mainland or stay in Hawaii and just sort of, you know, stabilize and get their lives back. But, that's one of the other things that we're advocating around is to make it more equal footing. But, you know, it's extremely difficult, us not being based in the D.C. area, to try to do a lot of the advocacy work for Congress. You know, we work in large partnerships as a national network with a lot of organizations that work on the issue of trafficking. And, yeah, I mean, on the one hand, we're busy sort of serving our clients, providing services. And as I said, we do conduct a lot of advocacy work. But, you know, we wish that it would really gain a lot of momentum. Hopefully through your show, a lot of listeners are going to sort of be mobilized to draw support for a lot of these bills that are trying to pass to make, as you mentioned, you know, to subject those islands and those territories to the same kinds of laws. And, you know, we're doing our best to try to make that happen, but it's been really challenging given our resources.
You're listening to WGDR Plainfield in Vermont, 91.1 FM, with Nam Ju Cho, the Communications and Policy Director for the Coalition to Abolish Slavery and Trafficking. We're discussing human trafficking and modern-day slavery and slave labor. We talked earlier about how, although a lot of the trafficking is done by organized crime, it's the the number three and fastest growing organized crime business, but a lot of the trafficking takes place on a smaller personal level. Or is there any movement to build a sort of a database that all the groups working in this area could access to coordinate their efforts a little bit better? I read a little bit on the International Organization for Migration website, and they had some sort of database they were trying to get started.
By database, do you just mean a database to kind of monitor the traffickers?
To keep track of people that are known to be involved with it or previously known to be involved with it, so that could, because what I read was about some cases in Canada where, especially with sex trafficking, what they'll do is they'll take the women from city to city every 3 or 4 weeks, so it's nearly impossible to keep track of them, or they're not there long enough to really recognize that there's a problem because the faces are always changing.
Exactly. That's very true. We do have some efforts to sort of try to collect that data. However, again, it's just been challenging, and we've been trying to work with a lot of law enforcement on the federal level to try to be able to collect more comprehensive data. And I think they've also faced a lot of challenges too, because it's sort of beginning and there just wasn't a lot of, there weren't a lot of resources there. One of the things that we're trying to do, at least on the respective state levels, is that we at least try, because it's easier to gather data because it's a smaller pool, of course, at the state level. We're trying to introduce legislation, and we've actually done so, to create task forces on the statewide level. And the task, one of the goals or one of the deliverables of the task force is to collect better data. So, I mean, that includes what you just said about who are these traffickers and, you know, can we have a database of these perpetrators, but also just, you know, data on the extent of the problem, number of victims, number of cases being prosecuted, number of, you know, survivors or clients who are getting the services. And I think that's really important. Hopefully down the road we can have a more comprehensive federal effort. I think that the federal efforts haven't been as comprehensive as we would like. And I think that considering they haven't really been able to prosecute or investigate as many trafficking cases as we all had hoped, maybe this is sort of being on the, you know, going to the back burner, even though, you know, we see the importance of it. Sort of the immediate need of prosecuting, you know, a lot of the traffickers is maybe taking a priority over that for now. But I think I think there's definitely an awareness of how important it is to try to collect this data. At the state level, again, in California, at least, we just introduced comprehensive trafficking, anti-trafficking state legislation. And I think a lot of states nationwide have introduced legislation as well that creates this task force. And the hope is that, you know, that they'll be compatible, a lot of those databases that are being formed at the state level. And at some point, we could somehow connect a lot of the resources and then compile them so that we can have a view of what it is nationally. But I think it's sort of at its beginning stages, and we're hoping that it's going to become more comprehensive in the future.
What would people just in the community look out for? How would they recognize that there might be a problem in their community that they could tip off to an organization such as yours or to law enforcement that there may be a trafficking situation? What would they be able to notice, do you think?
Yeah, that's a very tough question, because, you know, we probably come into contact with some of these victims, you know, unbeknownst to ourselves, when we go to restaurants or when we, you know, go out to, just hotels. Some of them might be trafficked as hotel workers. And it's very difficult to say, well, what are the signs that we should look for? But, you know, typically we would say, well, does this person, you know, look like they're really scared? Oftentimes when I go to restaurants, sometimes the waitress, who sometimes may not or, you know, speak very good English, looks extremely scared and intimidated at all times. And I think that it's a tough call to, so I try to decide, well, do we ask this person questions and kind of, you know, will this person be insulted if we think that this person is a victim of trafficking? But you just, I guess, have to go with your instinct. And, you know, some of the questions you need to ask this person is basically, you know, do you need help, obviously? You know, are you free to leave if you want? And there's, you know, there's a language barrier that comes to mind as to how you're going to be doing this. If you happen to speak, you know, Spanish or another language other than English, it would be useful. But, you know, again, they're so invisible that, and the traffickers are becoming savvier and savvier as far as how they enslave these people. So, you know, they're not going to really let these people out in public, period. So when they do, it's just about, you know, asking the person the right questions, the victim, and making sure that the trafficker or whoever the employer pretends to be is not there when you ask those questions. Or it can be as simple as, you know, handing a small note saying, you know, do you need help? Or, you know, please call 911 for help or something like that. A lot of our clients had no idea what 911 is, you know, until they got out of the situation. So, again, it's very difficult to say, well, what are the signs? But it's about, you know, I think that a lot of people can make a difference by, as you said before, becoming a very conscientious consumer, because I think we can do a lot by being, you know, a consumer. We have a lot of power by being a consumer, as we saw in the case of Taco Bell. So I would say, you know, search websites like sweatshopwatch.org to see what organizations, you know, are clothing companies that maybe you should be boycotting because of their labor practices. And if you see something that's, you know, seems wrong, or you suspect something in your neighbor's house, you know, slip them a note. If you can, you know, try to, if you see them alone, taking the kids to school or something like that, just, you know, say hello and say, hey, how are you doing? Our client, who was also enslaved as a domestic servant, she said that she took the kids to school every day, so she was able to get out of the house every day. But she never stopped anywhere. She never talked to anyone, and she would meet the neighbors on her way to and from school. And then the neighbors were very friendly, and they would say, hello, how are you? And she never even locked eyes with them because she was so afraid that they were in the same camp as a trafficker. So, you know, maybe just trying to extend a helping hand, maybe a note. And if you don't feel comfortable with doing that, I would say, you know, your consuming power is much stronger than you think.
In the last couple of minutes here, if you want to kind of describe a little bit more detail about the work you do at the shelter and mm-hmm. give some contact information for your organization so the listeners can get in touch with you and maybe help out financially or otherwise.
Absolutely. There are a whole lot of things that you can do to help out this anti-trafficking movement. And, you know, if you could, we always need a lot of help as far as doing different chores and different activities. As you know, there's, you know, a lot of the funding on trafficking is going to be cut off by the federal government, and we receive some funding from the federal government. So any kind of volunteer work that you could do, either, you know, to cast if you're going to be coming to the Los Angeles area, or there are a lot of organizations in the East Coast as well who do a lot of anti-trafficking work, you know, that you could, and we'll be happy to, you know, give you the resources, and you can email us at any time at info@castla, that's castla.org. Again, that's info@castla.org. We're going to be having a website launch fairly soon. Right now it's sort of being developed. But once that's developed, you know, we're going to have a lot of resources and information on this issue, what you can do to help. And you know, if you feel like very generous and you want to donate some resources, that would be fantastic. And the website address is www.castla.org. Once again, that's castla.org. And, you know, other than donations and volunteer work, it's really about spreading the word to your peers, to your teachers, to your own communities, your family members, about how slavery still exists today and what they can do to help. Sort of reiterating what I've already told you on this show. And, you know, write to your government representative about, you know, there are a lot of policies that are in the pipeline right now on the state level and also on the federal level that pertains to trafficking and immigrants' rights issues. You know, write to your government representative about supporting a lot of these bills or opposing a lot of the bills that are going to be, you know, harmful to our cause. And, you know, if you need any information on that, feel free to email us and we can, you know, give you as much information as you need. And finally, be a conscientious consumer again, and be selective as far as, you know, what produce you get or what sort of clothes you buy that are sweatshop free. We at CAST, we're very proud that we had our first set of clients graduate last year from our services. But, you know, graduating, and it doesn't mean that, you know, their cases are just, you know, they just no longer have any kind of contact with us. In fact, this is when they sort of become, they join our leadership development program, and we started the first of its kind, a survivor advisory caucus, which is a group of survivors who are stable enough in their healing process to be able to, you know, to want to give back to the community and to serve as advocates. And I think that's critical, because a lot of the movements that have been happening as far as anti-trafficking work, at least in the United States, hasn't been as, you know, victim-led or survivor-led as we would like. And I think that it's an extremely valuable direction to take. And we're hoping to facilitate the process for a lot of these survivors to become advocates. Not everybody is interested, of course, but those who are, we have skills building workshops, and, you know, they are able to conduct interviews and speak at hearings. And a lot of our clients have already done a lot of that. And we're very excited that one of our survivors may sit on the California Anti-Trafficking Statewide Task Force because of the advocacy work that we were able to do and her interest in the issue. So please, you know, support in any way that you can. And thanks again for having us.
And best of luck with what you're doing. It's a very noble cause.
Thank you very much.